Welcome to the Know It Some podcast, bringing you the widest variety of conversational interviews for a well-rounded perspective on life. Because while it's true nobody likes a know-it-all, it's also good to know it some. Here's your host, Steve Platt.
That's right. Welcome back to the Know It Some podcast. I'm your host, Steve Platt. And this week's interview is with the always funny and very charming Emily Branwen. She goes into her career as both an improv comic and a former CIA disguise and operations officer. She's got really cool story, quite the journey to share with us. And we had a lot of fun with this interview. I got to say, in my top five since I started the show in terms of how much fun I had with the interview, it reminded me of the interview with Paul Tay where you just don't want it to end. And honestly, it had to because we had stuff going on that day. So someday we will have her back on the show. She can regale you with stories from her time in the CIA, at least whatever she's allowed to share, right? But on here, we talked about so much, to include how she found herself in the CIA. And also, we got some TV recommendations, a bunch of cool stuff throughout this interview. You'll see just what I mean. Within the first 5 minutes, you'll see just how cool of a guest she is. I cannot do her bio justice, so you're going to have to check out her website. It's CIASpyGirl.com, and if you go there, you'll see all the really cool things she's done, bunch of media appearances, some of which are better than the Know It Some podcast. I don't know if we'd even make the list, let's put it that way. So you got to check her out. Really, really cool guest, and I know that you guys are going to love her. Please, without further ado, welcome my friend Emily Branwen. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the Know It Some podcast. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
It is an honor to have you on the show. I think your story is really, really cool. And I know you're probably tired of telling your journey and your story, but the listeners need to hear this one. So definitely fun having you on.
Thank you.
Talking pre-show, though, you mentioned that there's a certain ex-governor that you went to Sunday school with. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I'm from Missouri and I'm from St. Louis. And the joke with us, anybody from St. Louis, is that it's so small. Everybody knows each other. And like my husband's always like, you all don't know each other. I'm like, no, we really do. Oh, and by the way, Eric Greitens, who, you know, the disgraced governor from Missouri, who just put out the ad of him like hunting and killing people who don't believe in his beliefs. Yeah, I went to Sunday school with him. I think we drove carpool. I think he was a couple years older. I was not invited to his bar mitzvah, so I'm still bitter about that. But yeah.
I don't think you would have wanted to be there, just judging by the man he has become.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, but I have to interrupt you.
Go.
So do you know what's so crazy about this? He did this interview maybe 6 or 7 years ago, like before crazy, so BC. Uh-huh. And he talks about this mentor that he had at the synagogue we attended. And I know this man. Like, he is the most, his role model is the most principled man, the kindest man, gentle, socially conscious. Like, you look at this man, you're like, he's what we need in this world.
Right.
And it's supposedly an era went on and on how this guy was his mentor, blah, blah, blah. It's so contrary to where he is now. I'm like, oh, I don't know if the guy's still around. If he is, I'm sure it's paining him to see what has happened.
Yeah, I think he might not have picked up everything that was being put down there.
No.
The thing about it is, the gentleman that you're speaking of, I'm sure, is of such high class and standard that he's not going to go out there and he's not going to, you know, trash this man in the media and distance himself or anything like that, because he is of a certain character. Whereas, you know, this particular ex-governor, right, is someone who I think, whether you're on the left or the right, you don't really want much to do with. And that's saying something, you know.
Yeah.
You know, personally, like, I think last episode of this show was the first time I ever got into a political conversation. I purposefully avoided it, made it about 40 episodes in, and then, you know, it's out there that that I feel kind of politically homeless, that I don't feel a part of either party right now, and I don't feel that either party's politicians have really been serving our best interests as Americans.
And so here's a guy that I think whether you're on the left or the right, we can all come together and say he does not need to be back in office.
See, we can unify behind something. How horrible this guy really is.
So. It's something we could all come together on. I was absolutely shocked, even though it's a kind of a light agreement and might not have as much teeth as some would want. I was absolutely shocked that there was anything that the parties could agree on regarding some common sense gun control. And so to see that come out and then to see everybody agree that this governor needs to come out, there's going to be a snowball maybe, right? Probably not, though.
That's beautifully optimistic of you. I also think where you stand politically is probably where a lot of Americans stand because it's become so divisive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people just want, I think most people just want a middle. They want to be able to have political discussions at the dinner table without somebody, you know, bringing out a gun and threatening their life. You know, they want to be able to have good discourse that's right. Intelligent and deep without it becoming this contentious battle. It's really tough. And I think it's tough for people personally when you have family members who believe differently and, you know, you just kind of like stay away from this conversation. You just have to stay away. You know, it's hard.
Yeah. And the emotions have gotten stronger. And so people end up name calling and turning it into personal attacks. And maybe the isolation did that to some extent, ramp it up a little bit.
Didn't help.
You know, but certainly I think a lot of folks are on edge and they're expecting the vile attacks from the other side. So they're armed with it themselves. And they go into these discussions not from a place of, well, let's see what we can agree upon, or at least let me hear your viewpoint and your perspective. It's just they're readying the next attack. The last guest, Gary Sheffield Jr., he was talking about how anytime gun control comes up, the people on the right want to immediately bring up Chicago and some cities that have strong laws. And then each side, you know, he went into each side's talking points. And it's true, because I don't think I've ever heard a conversation on gun control that don't have the same handful of talking points from either side of the debate. I think people have those at the ready and are not really necessarily listening to how the other person feels and the perspective that the other person's coming from, right?
I don't think we do a lot of listening anymore. I think it's literally, you know, we're monologuing at each other. You know, there's no more dialogue. I think we're just like literally talking at each other and then hoping like one or two of those words will stick in their brain. But yeah, there isn't a lot of that dialogue.
Yeah, it's true. But I, you know, what's refreshing is talking to somebody like you who doesn't just monologue. It's kind of to have a real conversation. Your background's interesting because I think long before you joined the CIA or did any of that, you have a bit of a theater background. Is that correct? You grew up?
Yes, I was a theater nerd. So like full on theater nerd. I went to school for it and trained in it. And I thought I was going to be an actor when I graduated college, and then got very into comedy and performed with a few different improv comedy troupes. And, you know, I was kind of, you know, I was not doing like what my parents probably dreamed I would do. You know, I graduated from school, moved back home because that's what you do when you're a theater major,
right?
And joined an improv comedy troupe in St. Louis. And so there's not a lot and there's only a few venues. So we would like perform at like comedy clubs, but then like I would invite my parents to come see a show and have to tell them, okay, you're going to see a strip bar. I'm not performing at the strip bar, but there's a door right next to the strip bar. Go in through that, make a right, and there it is. And so they were pretty excited for me to get out of the house and embrace that empty nest syndrome. And so randomly, it was actually my mom who found the job. She was, again, tired of me being at home, but she was a huge spy nut, like one of those moms. Actually, not like any mom I've ever heard of. I can't believe I said
one of those spy nut moms, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
She used to see all the James Bond movies, read all like the Janet Ivanovich books, and at night she would peruse the CIA website for fun, because that's what you do. And she put an ad on my bedroom floor in my little twin bed bedroom. And I woke up and I read it. And at first it was, you know, the wording was looking for adventure, want to see the world. And I thought, oh shit. My parents want me to join the army. And I was in a remedial gym class, and I'm not even saying that for a laugh. It literally was a remedial gym class where they They had me throwing like a ball against a wall over and over again because they thought that would improve my motor skills. By the way, it didn't.
So you were not an All-American athlete in high school?
Oh, God, no. I was consistently picked last, and I was always given the position in kickball to guard the outfield where the teacher's parking lot was.
A little further back.
Yeah, keep going. Keep going near the Hondas in the back.
There you go.
That was always my – and for the record, no balls ever came out there. So I think I did a great job.
Yeah. Well, you know – I think at the end of the season, everybody gets a trophy. So you probably were doing okay there with sports. Your mom sounds like somebody that I'd want to be friends with. She sounds super cool. So what did you think when you saw that kind of advertisement and that opportunity? Like, was it immediately like, yeah, okay, that sounds great. Let's do this. No.
I literally thought she was crazy. Mm-hmm. And I started laughing because I thought it was a joke. And she said, if you apply for this job, you can continue to live at home rent-free. I literally heard the words rent-free and said, I'll apply. I knew they weren't going to hire me. Who's going to hire a theater nerd who once wore an eye patch for a lazy eye? My prospects looked very slim in my eyes. So I didn't think I would get it, but it would buy me some time. And then,
right.
You know, much to my chagrin.
When you saw, you know, Tom Cruise and, you know, all the different men that have played James Bond and stuff, you didn't see yourself doing Spycraft?
Oh, no. It wasn't even – I saw myself working on a movie about it, if I was so lucky. I saw myself in the audience watching those movies, but I never had a dream to do that. I was always interested in U.S. history and politics. That was always an interest of mine, so it's been nice I can revisit it now.
Right.
But – it was never something I could even fathom. It wasn't a dream or a thought I would even entertain to have.
Yeah, I completely relate because I was a theater nerd in high school, musical theater at that.
Okay, what shows did you do?
We did Guys and Dolls. We did Godspell. We did a number of the stereotypical kind of stuff.
Like what? Don't just drop two. I'm a theater nerd, musical theater nerd. I can out-nerd you any day, so I need to hear the rest of the shows.
We did one, and this was my freshman year, so I'm really trying to think back to the title, but I think it was called Working. And that was
old school.
Yes, yes.
It's not great.
I remember a song called Mother Trucker, Brother Trucker it was. But we had an interesting little theater department. It's an all-guys Catholic high school. So all the girls we pulled from surrounding schools. And that was a major draw for people to join drama, actually, high school. And we did a number of different productions there. And then towards the end of high school, I started doing stand-up.
Nice.
And they thought, well, he's theater and he's stand-up, so he can do improv. No experience and no training. And so they threw me out for we were raising money for cancer research. It was a charity improv night. And it's in Miami, big venue. A lot of people in a big city coming to see this thing, especially because it's for charity. And I didn't know anything about improv, not yes and nothing.
You didn't even know yes and,
nothing. And I did horribly. It was worse than you could ever imagine bombing doing stand up, and been very hesitant to ever try improv again. So hats off to you. I don't know how you do what you do with improv. It is not as easy as it may look to somebody in the audience.
Well, when you watch shows like Whose Line, it looks like it's breezy because they're so fantastic at it that it looks effortless, but it's really hard. And it's also a totally different beast from stand-up. Stand-up is horrifyingly frightening because it's just you on a stage and you're completely vulnerable, completely out there, hoping people laugh at what you think is funny. And improv is totally horrifying because you have no script. And so you just fly.
Yeah.
But I also think I tell everybody when people somehow ask me for career advice, which I'm like, really? Okay. I always tell them take an improv class and take a writing class. And if you do those two things, I think those are two skills that will help anybody in any career path that they want to do.
Absolutely. I mean, just in building confidence, right?
Exactly.
In improv class, even if you don't have aspirations of being in a troupe, it can definitely, I think, build somebody's confidence that, hey, you know, I can adapt and improvise and overcome, right?
Yeah, you can feel comfortable if you have to give a work presentation. You can take a lot of those rules and incorporate it into your daily life. Like we always talk about yes and, but that's become a motto that my husband and I use all the time. And we're not theater nerds at home. I mean, I am, but he's not. But the whole concept of if you have an opportunity, just say yes. I mean, as long as you're not going to, you know, die or something, but you say yes, because at the very, very least, you're going to have a great story. And I live for a good story. So at the very least, you get that.
Oh, yeah. No. And if you say no to a lot of things, there might be an opportunity that comes out of left field that you wouldn't expect to turn into anything. Exactly. That could have been your shot, right? So
absolutely.
Very, very, very cool stuff. So you apply for the CIA on a whim, rent-free move for you.
Of course, yes.
What happens next there?
You know, I truly didn't think I was going to hear anything. And lo and behold, the joke's on me, because after about a month or two, I started getting mail from the agency. And usually it's just a manila envelope with no return address.
Right.
And asking me for more, you know, information, whether it was on my family, a lot of like short answer questions. So I equate it to, you know, applying to college, but 18 of them all at once while listening to heavy metal music. It's a little crazy inducing, because there's just so much of it. Right. And then it kept going and I thought, oh my gosh, okay. And I was as shocked as anybody else. And then I started getting calls from people with one name at the agency, you know, hi, this is Linda, we're going to fly you out. And then I started getting, you know, flown out to DC to do a polygraph or to do an interview with a CIA shrink. And at that point I thought, I think this is going to happen. You know, you kind of get to that point where, oh my gosh, it's also an incredibly long process. And I hear they're trying to shorten it because they really need qualified applicants, but it took probably a year and a half from start to finish. By the time you do the preliminary stuff, you do your interviews, you do your polygraph, you do, you know, your psych interviews, and then they send the FBI in to do background checks, because everybody who works at the agency essentially carries a TSSCI clearance, which is a top secret clearance. And so you have to go through all of these things so they can basically entrust you with the nation's secrets.
Yeah. And that's not a fun process. I went through it in the Marine Corps.
Really?
Fill out the SF-86, and they talk to everybody you've you know, dated and worked with and all sorts of different things. And if there's something there, they'll find it.
Yeah. Oh, oops. Somebody's calling me and it's crap. Okay. Sorry about that.
Hey, no worries.
It comes in on my phone. I was like, I don't know anybody from this country. I always joke. I'm like, spam really likes me. Spam risk always comes up on my phone. And I'm like, I have a very personal relationship with spam risk. They call me all the time.
They don't even do research for spam anymore. They'll call you student loans you don't have. And
oh, your car warranty. I've had so many car warranty calls.
Yep.
I'm like, have you seen my car? Did you have to do a polygraph in the Marines?
I actually didn't get that far. They found a very, very small amount of debt that I had incurred in college. We're talking like 13K. I say small because I know people that come out of dental school with like 500,000 in student loans.
Absolutely.
But this was a small amount that I had never paid on because, you know, I dropped out of college and I was making peanuts, doing, you know, jobs that are important. I'm not saying they're not important, but not necessarily high paying jobs for a while up until I got into the Marine Corps. And so some of this debt had gotten into collections and stuff. Financial risk is one of the first thing that will X you out of that. So fun story, middle of Marine Corps boot camp, I go from being an intelligence contract to open contract, which means you could be anything. You could be infantry, you could be a cook, you could be whatever. And you'll find out at the end of boot camp. So that was over my head all of boot camp. which was kind of cool. But I ended up in a really cool job in the Marine Corps doing aviation ordnance, and paid off the debt and ended up getting my secret clearance, which is not as cool as a top secret compartmental line. Cool. But hey, it's something. And all's well that ends well there. But
I just want to say thank you for your service.
Oh, no, it was an honor. It really was, Emily. It was great, and a lot of friends for life from there, and really was a huge stepping stone for me in my life. So
I do think it's ridiculous that any student would be, or a young person be, disqualified for student debt. It is such a crisis in America right now, and it is swallowing people up whole. Mm-hmm. And people are not going into different professions because they know they're going to be swimming in debt when they finish. And so you have people who want to go into careers as therapists or teachers or intelligence in the military, and they can't because they have student loan debt. And that, to me, it's ridiculous. And I think we as a country need to do so much better.
Oh, I know. I really do. And I tried arguing the point with who it was that was interviewing me, and they were getting down to, how much did I spend going to a movie year?
At that point, their decision's done. But just for folks who are listening, the reason that debt is such a big issue, especially if you're applying for an intelligence job, is that they see that as a vulnerability. And so really, they want to make sure that to an enemy or for an adversary of the U.S., they're not going to look at you and say, oh my gosh, he's vulnerable because he's in debt. Maybe we can turn him. Maybe we can recruit him to give us secrets, and in exchange we can give him money because we know he's in a vulnerable place.
Absolutely. And so what it is. And I understood it, to an extent. I thought the amount being so small and it was so easily cleared, that could have saved me. But they look at it twofold. You're liable to a bribe, but then also it does show a certain amount of irresponsibility, I guess. And so they had their reasons, and it's something that apparently was very common. So
it's very common.
When I saw how common it was, I realized I couldn't really fight it right there in the moment.
No.
Which is funny. Like, I ended up going into financial services. That's what I do as my day job.
That's hilarious.
All the time. So it's funny. Things change over time.
Well, and it's at the point you can't argue with the government. I remember my first couple of months when I was at the agency, I worked in the disguise department, because there was a disguise department, CIA. It was my first job there. And I had to get a signature on something. And this guy said, I don't care where you get the signature. You can get on a matchbook. I just need a signature. I was like, okay. So I get my boss at the time a sheet of paper, and it's signature on it. I was like, can you sign this? She's like, this is the off-white sheet. I need the A crew one. And I was just dumbfounded. I'm like, the A crew? She's like, not the eggshell one. So we're having this debate. I said, this is ridiculous. All he needs is a signature. We sounded like we were debating a J crew ad. Like, it was ridiculous. But a friend of mine who was a mentor, her name was Louisa, she's amazing, she's in the Navy, she grabbed me, pulled me aside, and she goes, this is your first pissing contest, you're getting all wet, you cannot win. I'm like, but, and she said, it doesn't matter how reasonable you are not gonna win, she will always win. I was like, what? Oh, yeah. And she just shut me down.
It sounds like that the agency is very similar to the military in terms of the amount of common sense that's allowed. they could only allow so much, and then after that, it's just too much. It boils over. But yeah, I've been there with the forms. The thing is, though, since I didn't get to the polygraph itself, I got to ask you. I have friends that have undergone polygraphs for like law enforcement and different things, and they say that the more honest you are, like, the more nerve-wracking that thing can be. Because they're like, have you ever stolen? And you're like, I stole a pencil,
I confess to stealing frozen yogurt at my first job at Sweet Delight in St. Louis, Missouri. And I was in tears, like tears streaming down my face. And I was like hyperventilating, like, I did steal something. And my polygrapher, who was very intimidating, was like, what did you steal? And I was like, frozen yogurt. I stole so much because my dad was overweight and I wanted him to have a healthy treat.
Oh
He
my
looked
God.
at me like I was crazy. Then he said, "We're talking about grand theft, $10,000 or more." He started crying again. I was like, "I've been stealing for 3 years, so I don't know what could be. You do the math."
Oh man.
And then he decided my froyo crimes weren't a matter of national security. It wasn't going to be a threat, and I passed on.
I'm
But
glad
yeah.
that we no longer disqualify people for yogurt. We have come a long way.
My froyo crimes, I still got hired.
That's hilarious. That's really funny. So, initial training, like, what's that like? Were did you have to go through any sort of training that was out of the realm for you? You mentioned working
Oh.
in the disguise department, right? I think that would probably feel at home for theater, but did you ever have to
Yeah.
firearms or anything like that, or?
There's a term they always use at the agency, which I always think it's like when your parents say, "Because I said so." And at the agency, it's always, it depends, because every job at the agency is unique. It's not every, but 90%. You don't go to school for espionage. You don't go to school to learn how to create a disguise for an intelligence officer. These are
Right.
all very, unique jobs where you have to acquire that skill set really at the agency. So no matter what you're doing, you're going to be getting training. And I got training when I was a disguise officer. And then when I changed and became an operations officer, I went to The Farm, which everybody's probably heard about and seen that movie, The Recruit, where they do that. Nobody looks like Colin Farrell, by the way, there. Not one of them. I looked, I was like, "Where's Colin? I don't see him." And that's basically spy school where they teach you everything from, surveillance to how to recruit it, an officer and everything that would go into being an operations officer. And because if anybody listens to this at the agency, they're going to yell at me. So I want to make it clear, CIA officers who are operations officers are not spies. Everyone calls them spies, but they're really not. We recruit people to commit espionage. So we're recruiting a foreign asset to give us their secrets. So we're not, which to me feels very American, we're not doing the dirty work. We're hiring somebody, recruiting somebody to do the dirty work. Of course, if we get caught overseas doing it, it is a crime, it is criminal, but we're not doing that work. And so when people say spy, it's always people at the agency or, our antennas go up and we're like, "That's not the right nomenclature." Because we work for the government and we have to be nerdy and wonky like that.
Intelligence operatives, whether they're doing reconnaissance, whether they're doing espionage or anything like that, I think that they probably don't like the word spy as much as we
No.
do out in the general population.
Yes.
But when I hear spy versus spy, like Mad TV, like that's what I think of when I hear spy. Is
Exactly.
but very, very cool that you were able to do that, because you have some training that I think a lot of people, we as a people, we like to watch movies about it. We kind of like romanticize it, right? As something that's
Absolutely.
really, really cool. And then you get to kind of see behind the curtain as to, okay, well, maybe it's not all that romantic, but still very, very cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's still a government job. So it's funny because people always ask me when they hear I worked for the agency, which, by the way, it's the most sexist, misogynistic, a horrible question. But people always say, "Oh, you worked for the CIA, you were an operations officer. Okay, how many people did you have to sleep with?" And I always look puzzled. I'm like, "I'm sorry, could you repeat? Well, how many people did you sleep with?" Because obviously, as a woman, that's the way you're going to get intelligence. No male officers ever ask that question. And by the way, it's the biggest no-no ever to have a relationship with an asset. You get fired immediately, essentially.
Gotcha.
But
So the Mr. and Mrs. Smith kind of stuff, the James, people watching too many movies and then decide to ask you that question, which they somehow think is an okay question to ask, which is a whole other thing.
Steve, what's worse is they don't say, "Did you?" They ask, "How many?" Because they automatically assume, looking at me, like, "Oh, okay. So she totally did that. Curious what her number is."
Oh man. Well,
Oh, people
I
are
mean,
fun.
it is incredibly offensive, but Somewhere in there has to be a compliment. I don't know. You probably get used to getting kind of ignorant questions from folks that don't know any better. I would imagine you've gotten that more than once.
Oh, I mean, I'm on Twitter, so I get it every day. I've been accused of killing Kennedy when I pointed out I wasn't born yet. Mm-hmm. They said it was part of the master plot. I'm like, yes, that's what it was.
Gotcha. So, but just to be clear, did you sleep with Ted Cruz's father before or after the assassination?
I'm sorry. I'm going to be ill right now with that thought of Ted Cruz. All of a sudden, I taste bile all over. This interview is done now.
He has the most punchable face, I think, of any senator in the United States Senate.
He's so repugnant. He is absolutely repugnant. He is soulless. He has no character, he has no spine. He would sell his soul for a nickel.
But how do you really feel?
It's boggling to me that he has, honestly, as much as he's great to mock, we are so lacking in men and women of integrity to represent us. And the fact that he's representing, you know, the state of Texas, but he's not representing, he's representing his own interests. And he's letting them down consistently. Texas can do better. Missouri can do better. We can all do so much better.
I know. Look, you're about to really not like me, but that's okay.
Oh, no.
I'll share with you this. I was not a Ted Cruz supporter or voter. I'll let that out. There was a candidate who failed in the primaries that year. It was not Ted Cruz. There was a different candidate that you probably also have tons of.
Who was it?
Boards. I won't say.
No. You have to say. You cannot drop a bomb and not say who it is.
Because since then, they have shown their true colors. I mean, you saw it all along. But I was a Marco Rubio guy. Okay.
Okay. That to me is very fair. I think a lot of people were.
I had my reasons. Since then, obviously, he has done things to kind of dissuade me of that view. But I was. And I remember very distinctly. Following the primaries and watching Ted Cruz not long after his wife was insulted making phone calls for Trump. I don't know if you know the imagery that I'm talking about, but they had him basically campaigning. And it's when somebody's integrity is that easily overridden and sold and bought and sold, it really, from having the military background, right? Like, I think integrity is everything. And and so see that
everything.
It's really rough to see that, he's probably never going to leave office either, because he likes to see which way the wind's blowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And politicians that do that, they tend not to get voted out. They go with whatever the mass, even if it's a mob, even if it's an angry mob, they just champion the mob's cause because they know that the mob votes.
I don't agree with Kissinger. I just said his name wrong. I have a cold, so I apologize. Kissinger and or Cheney. 99% of the time, I don't agree with any of their politics. But I think right now they're people of integrity because they're standing up for the country. I can disagree with your politics, but if you still act with integrity and fortitude and intelligence and put country above party, that to me is respectable. It's completely respectable. And I think our country needs two parties, three parties. We need conversation and discourse to get better, but we're not having that. And people like Cruz, he's not interested in that. He's no interest whatsoever in that.
Oh, I know. And look, I know you probably don't have the kindest of thoughts towards Mitt Romney nor John McCain, but I think you can agree with me that we have moved in the wrong direction from that.
Exactly. I agree with you. I didn't agree with a lot of their politics, but I thought that they performed in a way that had integrity for themselves. I may have disagreed, but I didn't feel as though they were selling their soul.
Well, I mean, I remember, and this has gone around the internet now as a viral clip, but I remember when the town halls were happening in 2008. You know what I'm going to bring up.
Absolutely.
And
Obama.
The Obama is a Muslim thing and the whole deal. And, watching John McCain defend Obama as somebody he viewed as honorable, but you know, disagreed with his political stances, right? At a campaign event for himself, you know what I mean? He's campaigning against this man, and he's defending him. And it's like, I will never see that. I cannot picture any GOP candidate, or in fairness, you know, I will say I don't see it happening on the other side either these days, where they'll be at a campaign event and defend their opponent from something that is vile. I just don't see it happening.
It doesn't. Very few times can you think of an example. And how telling is it that we have to go back to 2008 to think of an example?
Yeah, we've fallen off. We've really fallen off. And again, you know, we're very quick to vilify anything that disagrees with how we feel. You know, I think it's kind of cool that despite the fact that I am, you know, a right-leaning independent, that you and I are able to have this conversation without it devolving into anything like that. So,
oh, I'm totally going to go Maury Povich on you later. Totally.
Well, that's okay. You can go Maury on me, because I, 2 episodes ago, I think it was, I revealed, like, towards the end of an interview that the guest I was interviewing was actually my nephew, and that we had found out through 23andMe in January. So you
That's
can't,
pretty yeah, cool.
Yeah. So you can't out Maury that. His mom reached out to me in January, like, I think we're siblings. And
turns
out that we are. My dad was a quite irresponsible 20-year-old in college in 1970, where there was no DNA testing or Facebook or Instagram or anything like that. So he had no idea he had fathered a child. And it turns out my sister's really cool. I got 2 nephews and the whole deal. But yeah, that was my most Maury episode yet of this show. And I don't know that I'm going to be able to top that in that department.
You can't, but how, maybe this is me being Pollyanna. I think it's sort of beautiful. You get this bonus family. You get a bonus sister and cousins and family that are wonderful.
Oh, it's the coolest thing.
It's so cool and special.
And we're sharing now in life events. They attended like a wedding event for my sister.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and one of my nephews is getting married, and so like we're all like it's a late in life blessing for my dad, you know, and to some extent for my sister, because she's a little bit older than I am, but. We're all just like super, super beyond the moon about it, like really happy about it. So, yeah. And
I love that so much. You have no idea. I'm like clutching my heart at this moment, because I just think it's so beautiful. It really is a blessing, especially in these crazy, chaotic times, too. You know,
for sure. I have a daughter, and, you know, I think about like what they missed out on as a relationship compared to like what I have with my daughter. But then to see them now, it's just really, really cool.
It is.
And yeah, you know, I brought him on because he works for a country music artist named Granger Smith, a pretty well-known one. And he does like all the marketing stuff. So I just brought him on as if we were talking about that brand and the apparel and, you know, touring with Granger and all that. You know what I mean? And then at the end of the episode, we kind of dropped that on the listeners and had a little bit of a reaction on the timeline and in the mailbox. So it's kind of cool.
I don't know any artist if they're not in a musical. I'm just going to say, as you said their name, I'm like, I have no idea who that is. I won't truly, if it's in the musical theater canon, if it was Patti LuPone, I would be crying and saying, tell me more. But yeah. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, so you know, you talk about artists and musicals and stuff, like, my favorite actors, singers, everything, comedians, they all tend to come from the same part of the country. I didn't know you were from St. Louis.
Yes.
At all. And what I was going to tell you is like Rob Riggle, who is both a comedian and a Marine.
Yep.
You know, John Hamm, Jenna Fisher, Brian Baumgartner, all these folks are all from
Kathy Madigan.
Yeah. And it goes on and on. They're all from like this breadbasket of the country. Like, you know, where like
Scott Foley.
Yeah. The coastal folk, you know, I grew up in Miami, and even when I was in the Sarasota station, either on one coast or the other at any given time, you know, we quite literally fly over the flyover states. And it's funny how much talent comes out of there, because some of the greatest, most creative people that we know seem to be from like that one little area of the country. I shouldn't say little, but you know what I mean?
And I think we get forgotten. It gets a bit of a bad rap and people sort of ignore it and just think, oh, Missouri, you know, and a lot of those areas, but it really is, there's so much talent. And going back, I don't obviously live there anymore, but whenever I go back, I feel more nostalgic. When I left, I think when you leave your hometown, you're like, ah, good riddance. But when I come back, I just realize how lucky. There's so many amazing people there, really beautiful people who are doing, you know, great things. I was thinking about a friend of mine and his family were refugees into St. Louis. They opened the first Vietnamese restaurant in St. Louis, and they're now this huge success. But I think it really speaks to the community because everyone is always saying, you know, the Midwest, they're so, you know, small-minded, blah, blah, blah. And I look at him and his family, and they've, you know, made this huge, huge impact on the community. And it just makes me feel just very, very proud. That's why I get so upset about the Eric Greitens, because they deserve better and they should do better. And they can be better.
Well, you know, I agree with you. And also, I don't think it would take very much to be better than that. I mean,
no.
Minus the senator from Texas, I don't know of very many folks that are worse than this particular individual. So, you know, to your point, like, they definitely can do better. And even if they want somebody that champions views that you and I don't agree with, that we both together think are you know, right or whatever, right? Like, I think you could still beat the vileness of what he's putting out there. That ad is just completely crazy to me. That we're in a time where that's considered, you know, okay to put on the air. You know what I mean?
It hurt my stomach and my heart to watch that. And it's, you know, there's no words for it. I'm watching this and I keep thinking, you know, it's so weird. I was thinking about it this morning and I thought, what did everybody think when they were on set making this ad?
Right.
Because, you know, all these people are coming together to produce this. Yeah. Was there anyone who thought, wow, this is dangerous and a really bad idea? But no, I mean, I looked up I was curious who works for him too. So I found a couple of folks, you know, on Twitter who work for his campaign. And I kept thinking, why are you guys okay with this?
There are answers there that, you know, but they're not good answers.
No.
Now, there has to have been at least somebody on that production company that thought they were filming an episode of Black Mirror or something. And, you know, I don't know. It's
just coming back, by the way, supposedly, the rumor mill.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Huh. Well,
I didn't just start the rumor, which I've been known to do. I know I read that it was coming back, which is very cool.
I have a problem, and I think a lot of people feel this way, so this is not a bold take. If anything, it's a mainstream take, but I feel like early seasons of a lot of shows, like Black Mirror, mm-hmm. were great, and like this last season didn't get me as much. I'm a huge fan of The Orville. I don't know if you watch it, but I felt like the first couple seasons were great, and then this new one came out, and it's good, but they decided to, you know, take a more serious tone and kind of leave out the humor, and it takes away a little bit of the fun of the show. The only exception I know of is Stranger Things. I think this latest season is the best season of Stranger Things. And I don't know if you're one that watches that at all.
I haven't kept up with that. We were latecomers to Ozark, but I felt like that consistently got better.
Yes. Yes. It built. Yep.
It definitely built. I thought we watched Curbed. And that to me is always consistent.
Yep. But it's Larry.
Larry David, and it's always just consistently great. I'm curious because I think Squid Game's coming out with a season two, and Severance is coming out with a season two, and their first seasons were so brilliant and striking and so wildly creative. I'm curious how they're going to go to the next season.
The creator of Squid Games had originally said he didn't want to do an additional season. They talked to him and probably paid him into it.
Yeah, I was going to say they backed up the Brinks truck and said, can we change your mind?
Yeah, I think it was the number one show on Netflix of all time or something like that. So, you know, hopefully they got a good storyline to it. But did you know that there is a
reality show for Squid Game?
Yes. Are you brave enough to sign up for it? Do you trust Netflix not to have the same exit policy?
The words I'm looking for are hell and no. Hell no, there is no way. But it's my husband always says, he's like, you should go on Amazing Race or The Survivor. There's no way I would even do that. I'm not doing Squid Game. I am, that's some crazy shit.
Yeah, so my wife said the same thing, and she also told me not to sign up. And of course, I went on the website to go sign up. And
Of course you did.
what I found was is that it says you have to be available for like 4 straight weeks of filming,
That makes sense.
wherever in the world that they want to take you to.
That
And
makes sense.
with my job and my two little, my little 2-year-old, that's not gonna happen. So I did not sign up, but I would if I had the free time.
How long have you guys been married?
Since 2016, so almost 6 years.
Oh,
Um,
congrats.
but I met her when I was a freshman in high school and she was a sophomore.
Oh, an older woman.
Yeah, just by looking at us, that's for darn sure. But I remind her of that consistently.
I'm sure that goes over really, really well in your home.
Free marital tip to anybody listening is remind your spouse that they're, if they are, that they're older than you. I think it's a great thing to do.
I do that to my husband because he is older than me, and every once in a while, he'll be joking with friends, and he'll make himself really young, and I keep saying, you cannot make yourself younger than me. Even in your lie, you cannot do that.
Oh man. So we met way back when, and we're both from the Cuban culture. We're both from Miami. My mom and her parents came over from Cuba as kids and the whole deal. And we go back to visit a lot, but what's funny
That's
is we
so cool.
lost touch completely when we hit college. Like we lost touch for somewhere in the range of like 7 or 8 years, maybe, something like that. And we reconnected. So,
I love that.
it's not a high school sweetheart kind of a story, but you could always reconnect with with somebody that you knew from your past. And for anybody out there, that's not necessarily outside the realm of possibilities. So,
You never know, and you just stayed open to it. It's yes anding. You
yes, it helped
that's
that I didn't date her in high school. We were friends, but I would have completely messed that up because I was not as mature as most high schoolers and saying something. So,
I love that.
yeah.
I hate to, and your marital advice is very, very good.
Oh, absolutely. How did you meet your significant other?
Well, my favorite part of the story is I was dating a real turd before him, and he was a stand-up. And it was so bad. I found out he lied about his name, his age, where he went to school, the fact he had hair, which is a long story. And he was also I shouldn't say kind of, he was a kleptomaniac. Like, we went to Costco and I saw him stealing frozen Uncrustables and eating them in like a little like walkway in Costco, like crazy.
I think that's called
So
a subway rat. Are you sure you didn't date a subway rat? That's
crazy, like literally insane. And I had
said
the
he was a
final,
guy.
he was a stand-up. And so at first I was like, oh, he's so funny. Oh, that's so sweet. And then I kept thinking, he's so crazy. I need to get away. And so the day I just thought, I was like, I had enough. He said to me, because he was also, I think I mentioned, a big turd. He said, you think you're so funny, so why don't you go out and do comedy again? And literally the next day, I joined the improv group and met my husband.
Boom. Yep.
I
That's
love it.
that is really, really cool. So, does he still do improv as well?
He doesn't. We like to say we retired after we found each other. Once we got married, we just kind of thought, you know what? I think we got what we're gonna get out of it. It's also hard in LA because in other cities you can do improv for fun. We weren't, he's got a career outside of this. I do too. So we weren't doing it to get discovered. And in LA, it's constantly this bringer culture, which when you hear the word bringer, it's that you're going to tell them how many people you're going to bring to the show. And so there's that constant, pressure of that. And we just thought, we're good. He ended up doing stand up for a couple of years and he was fantastic. And I loved that. But that was a ton of work, as you know. So,
Have you ever given it a shot, a stand up?
you know what? I've done, when we did improv, I would sort of host games and do little bits in that, but I've never done a real set. My husband and some of his friends have tried to pressure me into doing it, but it seems like so much work and it's really, really daunting to me. But I would love to try it. And now when he hears this, he's gonna taunt me and ridicule me. So thanks, Steve.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, you got to. I don't know if it would be the same for you since you have a history performing, but friends of mine in completely unrelated industries that have always kind of like wanted to, like, bucket list thing. They'll do the like open mic kind of a thing, and it's like a dare. Everybody comes out, they bomb, it goes terribly. The serious comedians that are there are annoyed that we're in the building precious
taking my time.
But as horrible as it is for the comedians there, for the person that goes up there, they even though they bombed and everything, they have no regrets. They're really glad they did it. Was fun. Never going to do it again. Really fun. That kind of reaction is what I get from folks when they give it a shot. I don't know that it would be the same for you because you've already had that fun of being a performer in, you know, countless settings. So you might just get the bombing part of it and then be like, why did I?
Way to sell it to me, Steve.
Well, I mean, I just don't know. You don't know until you try, Emily. You kind of write out a bit. 5 minutes is probably all you need.
It's your type five.
You should.
It's funny. My husband, that was weird. And his three buddies. Yeah, I know. That's very weird. I have a note to call my brother and I just saw it and I was like, oh, I have to call my brother. And weird. We can delete that. That would be the part where you can edit that because that's creepy.
What part of Alabama is St. Louis in?
Exactly. And the banjos come in. So what they did, which I thought was really cool, is they all wanted to do stand-up. So they said, let's treat it like a real thing. Like, so they called it the Stand-Up Project. And they would meet every other Monday together as a group, these four guys. And they would do their sets for each other. And then the three of them would give the other person notes. And so they would work on it and work on it. They would videotape it so you could take it home, make notes. And so it became this real effort. And so then once they felt like they had good sets, they would travel together and do open mic nights, take notes, record it, come back and refine it. And the end of like a year or maybe a year and a half, they rented out a theater and did the Stand-Up Project and did a night where all of them performed and did 20 minutes each. And I just thought it was so special and so cool that they had this goal and they saw it through for a year. They worked together and supported each other. It was beautiful. There was no competition. It was just so much love. And I loved how they did that. And it was such a great night.
That is awesome.
It was so cool.
That's a lot of work ethic for comedians. I really and truly think that's unique and cool that they fought through the whole way, you know?
Exactly. And I think they also had each other to hold them accountable. So yeah. I think that really helps too.
For sure. What are you up to these days? You know, your background being both a comedian, a writer, a CIA operative, you've kind of done it all. What is life like for you now?
It's funny, as you said that, I want to be a dog owner, but my husband is wildly allergic to dogs. So that is not something I'm going to add to my resume. Do you have a dog?
We don't at the moment. I grew up with dogs. We have a cat and I'm not historically a cat person, but this acts like a dog. So it works.
No, it doesn't.
It does.
It's still a cat.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Me as much as I love her, I don't know, but she does follow me around and like,
okay. Probably,
you know,
TV. Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
But what am I doing as I segued, hoping again my husband hears this and maybe we'll let to get a dog. I'm doing kind of a little bit of everything. When I left the agency, I wanted to figure out a way where I could combine my love of performing also with my background, because I know I have sort of a unique set of skills. I hate saying that. It sounds like that movie with Liam Neeson. I have a unique set of skills with...
Yeah. You will.
You know, I will find you.
Yeah.
And so I've been fortunate that there's been those opportunities, whether it was hosting a podcast, whether, you know, I've been able to write some, you know, essays or firsthand pieces for, you know, Time or Marie Claire, being able to express myself in that way, which is incredibly hard, and I have so much respect for writers because I think it's one of the toughest jobs ever. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing interviews talking about, you know, what's going on in the world whenever there's espionage questions. For me, what I hope to be able to do, because I think when you turn on the news, people who talk about the CIA, FBI, all that kind of stuff, there's a similarity in their voice. It's a lot of older white dudes talking about this, as opposed to having diversity of thought and a diverse voice talking about these issues. So I hope I can provide that and be, you know, a little bit more relatable.
That's awesome.
Especially now, because I think there's so much confusion that's going on, but to be able to talk about it in a way where people go, okay, I get it. That's why it's a risk. That's why it's a problem.
Yeah, I think you bring a perspective that is unique in that sense. And then also, when you watch current events, political events occurring all throughout the world, you probably look at it very differently than you know, myself or my wife might look at it, right? Because you have a background that we don't have. So if you're able to provide some color to what's going on, I think people need to be able to access that. Are you still able to watch quote-unquote spy movies?
Oh, God, no. My husband calls me the spy ruiner. He literally, he can't watch a movie with me because I ruin every single spy TV show or movie. We were watching the first season of Jack Ryan, and I lost my shit because Jack Ryan, he gets hurt, and the next day he gets an MRI. And I turned to my husband and said, it took Cigna 3 weeks to approve my MRI, but he gets it the next day. Of course, my husband said, you're not upset at the fact that a helicopter landed and picked him up to go on a mission. You're upset that he got insurance approval the next day for his MRI. I'm like, that's just the beginning.
What they don't show is an episode of him like trying to get his pay corrected with administration. And
exactly.
Yeah, I know.
What about his per diem? Can I see that?
Yes, the file is travel expense.
It's bullshit.
They just cut right past the important stuff, and you know, and to the helicopter they go.
But I will say the best TV show about espionage is The Americans.
Okay.
Because one of the creators was former CIA, and so he every script he wrote or they wrote they had to submit to the agency for approval, but. What was great is that he really, there's so many details that are so accurate for espionage at that time that it's exciting to watch because I go, oh, that's real. You know, of course, there's probably a lot more murder in that show than in reality, but The way they handle spycraft is it's really accurate and really cool. And so it's also a great show, but it's, I always say that to me is really the hallmark of a great spy show.
Yeah. Now that immediately jumped 100 spots on my watch list. But when you said that there's more murder than in real life, now I'm wondering what your body count is in a whole different way than we discussed earlier.
No, I meant more murder on the show.
Yeah.
No, not in real life. That's the other question people ask. Like, how many people did you kill? Yeah.
Well, I used to get that question as a Marine all the time, as if, you know, my job was Call of Duty. And it's frustrating.
It's also so insulting because our military go into war. It's not like they keep a tally. You know, they're in war. It's huge. It's to take a life. It doesn't.
When it stays with you for life too,
forever, and it's so disrespectful.
I know, but you know, more often than not, the people asking these kinds of questions, both what we discussed earlier and now, most of the time, they're not just meaning to come from a bad place.
No, it's just ignorance.
Yes,
really happens.
Yeah,
so completely.
I don't flip out on them for being that way. I just I have like some polite canned responses that I use to change the subject and move on, you know what I mean? Without, you know, making them cry, which I could. Can people find you?
At CIA Spy Girl, and that's on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay, that's great. Hey, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
This is so a lot. Fun.
You're welcome back anytime for sure. And, you know, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. And if you go to my Instagram, you'll see lots of pictures from my garden right now. I'm very excited. That's when I become old. I'm talking all about my garden. I'm like, look at my tomatoes. And it just means my tomatoes. It means there's nothing else that means.
You'll have a new garden follower from me for sure.
Oh, do you have a garden?
I do not, but I will now be interested in getting a garden once I see what you got going on.
I'm going to DM you some pics of my beautiful garden and my tomatoes. And that's awesome. All that means. Anyway, thank you so, so much. I really, this is so fun.
It really was. It was a fun thing. You have a good one.
You too. Bye.
And that'll do it for another episode of the Know It Some podcast. My thanks again to this week's guest, Emily Branwin. That was one of the most fun interviews I've done since I started the show, and I really appreciate the time you spent with us today. Folks, go ahead and give her a follow on Twitter or Instagram at CIA Spygirl and check out her website, CIASpygirl.com. And while you're at it, make sure that you're following us on your favorite social media platform. We are at Know It Some Pod all across social media. And you can follow us there, share our posts with your friends, and help us grow this audience and continue to bring you great guests. Another way to support the show would be to leave us a 5-star ranking and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podchaser, wherever you leave reviews for podcasts. Make sure you go on there and give us that 5-star ranking and review so we can get back to being a weekly show and bringing you great interviews like this one week in and week out going forward. I appreciate all the support, guys. It's meant a lot to myself and the entire Know It Some podcast family, the Roll Up Network. We appreciate all of it, and we will see you soon.